Great to be with all of you this morning. Appreciate the good leadership in the worship service this morning. I want you to turn to Hebrews chapter 11, if you will. We'll begin there this morning in our lesson. Hebrews chapter 11. Let me throw up on the board this chart of the judges, the cycle of the judges for you. You might be familiar with this. If you know the book of Judges in the Bible, after Joshua brought Israel into the promised land, they did not drive out all the nations around them. And after Joshua died and a generation arose not knowing the Lord, they started to go through this cycle where initially under Joshua there was peace in the land. Israel was serving the Lord. And then Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And God punished Israel by enslaving them through a nation that was around them. And then Israel would cry out to God for deliverance, and God would raise up a judge, which in our English vernacular doesn't really mean what it meant to them. The judge was a deliverer. And when it says he judged the people, yes, in that sense, the people would bring people to, like, for example, Deborah. They brought cases, situations, circumstances before the judge. But really, the idea of a judge was the idea of a savior or a deliverer. And so you could say that every judge in the book of Judges, in that sense, was a type of Christ, a type of the ultimate deliverer. And so you can approach the book of Judges from that standpoint and see a lot of parallels and a lot of symbolism in the book of Judges. Very interesting and fascinating to study through that. I really enjoyed a lot of that kind of digging that I did this week in preparation for the lesson. I won't be sharing 99.9% of that with you this morning, because it's deeper stuff that maybe would cause us to miss the main point, which I think we want to get across this morning. The main point I think we want to get across in our study this morning is God's grace and God's love and God's mercy, even with a sinful man such as Samson. And that's who we're going to be looking at this morning. You might notice this picture here up on the board, an artist's rendition of Samson pushing down the two pillars in Judges 16 and destroying more Philistines in that one event at the end of his life. It cost him his own life as well, but he destroyed more Philistines in that one event than he had in his entire life. And he had killed a lot of Philistines in his life as well. So this is the final act of Samson pictured here. But when you look in Judges 13 through Judges 16, you wonder why in the world is Samson in the Hebrews 11 Hall of Faith, what we call the Hall of Faith, you know, where Hebrews 11 lists all of the different men and women that died in faith and didn't receive the promises. Just doesn't list all of them, obviously, but the ones that are listed there, Abraham, Noah, Moses, David, men who you, when you look at their lives, you can see why they're included in that list. But in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32, the writer goes on to say, "What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, who was a judge, Barak, a judge, Samson, a judge, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets." And then he says, "Who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions." Well, that's Samson. He killed a lion in Judges chapter 14. And then it goes on to say, "Quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong." There's Samson again in that list, from weakness, after he had his hair cut off by the Philistines and he'd been blinded. And then he went into prison and he was grinding out wheat day or corn day after day. So he from weakness was made strong, became mighty in war. There's Samson, mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Samson did that as well. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. That was Samson, the end of his life, mocking, scourging, chains, imprisonment. So he's listing all of the things that happened to various people, and he's calling them all men of faith. And Samson's included in that list. And I got to tell you, after studying on this for quite a long time, I'm still a little bit struggling with that, but I think I have a better grasp of it. I think my grasp of it, though, comes not from trying to figure out how Samson was worthy of being called a man of faith, but comes more from the idea of how great God's grace and mercy and love is, even with a sinful man such as Samson. And I think we will see as we go through the story that God is working with Samson in a very special way, and yet Samson is such a profane man. He's such a carnal man. It's very difficult to understand why he would be listed in this chapter of faith as one that we would emulate in any way. You see his very special heritage that he had in chapter 13. He's announced by the angel of the Lord, who, for what I can understand, is probably Jesus. He won't even give his name. His name is Wonderful. "Why do you ask me my name?" the angel says, "seeing that it is wonderful." And throughout the Old Testament scriptures, we see a picture of the angel of the Lord on various occasions. And the evidence seems to indicate that this is likely Jesus. Because when people see the angel of the Lord, they see him as God. God has appeared to them. And so here's a man who is announced, his birth is announced by the angel of the Lord. He's set apart from birth as a Nazarite. Now, a Nazarite was someone who dedicated themselves to God. And they took basically three vows. Numbers chapter 6 and verses 1 through 8 look at the description of the Nazarite. The Nazarite is to not touch anything, not eat anything, not come in contact with the vine. Not any wine, not any grapes, not any raisins. And he's also not to touch a dead carcass, not to become unclean by touching anything dead. He's also not to have any of the hair of his head shaven. And a razor is not allowed to come to his head. And this would be the outward demonstration of his devotion to God. He's letting his hair grow. People are seeing that he's under a vow. And he's not drinking any wine. He's not eating anything of the fruit of the vine. So this would be an outward demonstration that he was under a vow of dedication and service to the Lord. Well, that was a vow people took on their own. That was never something that God required of anyone. But here, with Samson, God is announcing through the angel that this man from birth is going to be under the Nazarite vow. God's putting him under that vow. And from a child all the way until his death, he's going to be a Nazarite. He's going to be under that vow. Now, that was not the case with the Israelites when they took the Nazarite vow. There would come a point in time where they had fulfilled that vow and they had specific instructions as to what to do to fulfill the vow and to offer up sacrifices to God and to be cleansed and so on. And then they would no longer be under the vow. But Samson's under this vow from birth till death. He's very special in that sense. No other man was ever put under that kind of vow. Some have said that that alone makes him a type of Christ. And a lot of people have speculated on a lot of the different symbols that are in these stories to talk about how Samson is a type of Christ. And when I heard that and read that, I thought, man, I can't get my head around that at all. How is this carnal man, this ungodly, lustful, vengeful, angry man, a type of Christ? I still struggle with that a lot. But I'm starting to see how God is working through this deliverer and showing us, I think, part of our salvation that came through Christ. God works through even sinful men to accomplish his purposes and to bring about his plan. But look at his upbringing. He's raised by a prayerful mom and dad. He's the product of prayer. His mother is barren and God sends the angel to announce his birth. His father, when he hears about this, says, "Oh, please, let's call upon the man of God, the angel of God, to come back and tell us more about what we need to do in order to raise this son right." This is a prayerful, godly family. In a time and circumstance in which in the period of Judges, most Israelites were not. So he's got a great upbringing with a great mom and dad who are teaching him and training him what it means to be godly. And in chapter 13 and verses 24 and 25, it talks about how, and it appears that Samuel is now grown. He's at least a young man now. And the Spirit of God begins to move on him. And it doesn't explain what that means. But the emphasis there clearly is that God is with him. God is working through Samson at the end of chapter 13. And I'd say the first thing we notice about Samson is that he despised his heritage. By his future acts that we're going to see in chapter 14 and 15 and 16, he despised that heritage. He took it lightly. He indeed was a profane man. He lived as a profane man. Here he was under this special calling by God and given all of these great blessings by God, and yet he chose to live his life as a carnal man. A man who lusted and gave in to his fleshly desires, and a man who gave in to his desires for vengeance and anger towards his fellow man. I think of Esau in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16, who it says sold his birthright for a morsel of food, for a bowl of red stuff that he ate, that Jacob gave him, and he sold his birthright. The birthright was something very special. In fact, with Esau, it included the promise of God that in Isaac's descendants, all the families of the earth would be blessed. That was to come through Esau. But God had a different plan in mind, and it would come through Jacob, who was called the supplanter. So Jacob supplanted Esau as the one through whom the promise would come. Esau was a profane man, the writer of Hebrews says, who sold his birthright for a bowl of food. Well, you're going to see in Samson something very similar to that when he eats the honey out of the dead lion's carcass. We'll talk about that in just a moment. It brings us to chapter 14. He defies his parents in Judges chapter 14. If you want to turn there and read with me in verse 1. Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So this is a foreign woman. And so he came back and told his father and mother, I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. And then his father and his mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she looks good to me. She pleases me. I like her. So you see Samson violating God's law. God's law in Deuteronomy chapter 7 was that the Israelites were not to intermarry with the foreign nations around them, because what would happen is they'd become a problem for them and cause them to go into idolatry and cause them to sin. But Samson doesn't seem to care at all about that. His mom and dad do. His mom and dad are trying to get him to see that he shouldn't do that. And he says, no, she looks good to me. You go get her for me. I think of Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, where the Bible says that children are to obey their parents in the Lord, for this is right. But I really like verses 2 and 3, which go on to share with us the description of this command that is given in the Ten Commandments. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. That it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. I think sometimes children don't understand that at all. When they're taught by God to obey their parents and to listen to their parents' instruction, they don't seem to understand, like Samson didn't understand. This is going to be well for you to submit to God's commands and to obey God's rules and to be spiritually minded versus carnally minded, Samson. This is going to be good for you, that you may live long and well on the earth and be blessed by God. And Samson didn't give much thought to that at all. He looked at the woman and he said, she looks good to me and I want her. And so he imposed his will upon his parents, and his parents gave in to him. And that's something else to observe in our text. His parents should have obeyed God. They should have restrained Samson from doing this unlawful thing. But instead, they accompanied him down to Philistia and they obtained for him. And that's how it had to work. The father had to go and inquire and set it up and arrange for this marriage to take place. And so the parents are giving in to the unrighteous demands of their children, of Samson in this case. I think of another man who did that, Eli, one of the judges, the last judge of Israel. When his sons were profane and were actually even laying with women in front of the temple or in front of the tabernacle, they were that vile, they were that disobedient, and they were taking food for themselves, and they were just filled with covetousness and immorality and unrighteousness. And Eli went to them and he tried to talk to them about it and tried to tell them that they ought not to be doing that. But then when they wouldn't listen to him, he just tolerated. He was the high priest in the land. He should have had them put to death according to the law. That's what he should have done. Or at least somehow restrained them in some way. And that's what God finally accuses Eli of not doing. You should have restrained your sons. I think of 1 Samuel 2 and verse 29. 1 Samuel 2 and verse 29, where God is rebuking Eli. He says, "Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me?" And honor your sons above me. It's a good lesson for us as parents that this is the way God looks at our responsibilities as parents. There are going to be times, perhaps, like there was with Samson, where he wants to do something and he's really pushing hard to do it and he's determined to do it, and we as parents feel the pressure of tolerating it or allowing it or not restraining it, not disciplining it, and allowing it to happen. And God is saying, why are you honoring your sons above me? I couldn't help but think back to the lesson a couple of weeks ago on church discipline that we had. And I asked the question, you know, does this instruction of God apply to the family, to the mothers and the fathers, to the siblings? And could not God say the same thing to us when we refuse to honor Him and His commands because it hurts to discipline our children? And there are consequences that are very, very difficult to endure. Could not God say the same to us? Why do you honor your sons above me? And so we have to give thought to these things and recognize that this is a strong temptation for parents. And they gave in to Samson. In Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 24, it says, "He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly." It's just a general statement about a real truth about how we hate our children when we don't discipline them. Because as you can see with Samson, he goes down, and from this point on in his life is turned upside down. His life is miserable, and he makes the life of his parents miserable. He ends up violating his vow. He ends up causing them to become unclean. And on the process and the cycle of sin goes, and it all starts here with his parents not restraining him from doing that which was unrighteous and him taking them into sin. But God's going to use Samson's sin to weaken the Philistines. Verse 4 says, "However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines." It does not mean that God condoned this marriage to a foreign woman. It means that God was going to use this occasion that he knew Samson was determined to engage in order to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. He was going to use Samson's sin to accomplish his purposes. And so he continues to work with Samson. And in Judges chapter 14, verses 5 through 20, we have the beginning of Samson's demise. Judges chapter 14, verse 5, beginning. "Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that he tore him as one tears a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or mother what he had done." A lion came at him, and he took that lion with his bare hands and tore him to pieces. And maybe after this, he was aware that he was mighty. There's no indication that he was before that. But in any case, God uses this occasion to show Samson his great might and his great strength. And it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. So God is at work here in helping Samson to defeat this lion. I couldn't help but see some form of symbolism here as well in Samson's defeat of the lion. Here you have the strongest man, the mightiest man, and the lion, who symbolizes the mightiest of all the animals, and is portrayed in the Bible as Satan roaring about like a lion, seeking those whom he may devour. Couldn't help but see the symbolism here. And also, you couldn't help but see the fact that David killed the lion as well. And David makes that point when he goes against Goliath, that I have killed the lion, both the lion and the bear, and why should this heathen Philistine mock God? So you have Samson, mighty man, killing this lion. Again, perhaps foreshadowing that God is going to kill the lion through the true deliverer. Not the sinful deliverer, not the lustful, vengeful, carnal deliverer, but through the true deliverer, God is going to destroy the lion. Now, picking up in verse 7. So he went down and he talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. And when he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion, and behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the body of the lion. And so he scraped the honey into his hands and went on eating as he went. And when he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them and they ate it. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey out of the body of the lion, because presumably they would have not wanted to eat it because it was unclean. It came out of a dead body. And every Israelite was required to avoid anything, eating anything unclean. Not just Samson. But Samson in particular was under a vow that he would not touch a dead carcass. And yet he comes to the lion, he reaches inside the carcass of the lion, and he scrapes that honey out because he wants the honey. He wants to eat the food. Then he takes it and gives it to his parents. There doesn't seem to be any spiritual concept whatsoever in Samson's mind and heart in any of this behavior. He's departing from his vow, thinking lightly of it. He's like a profane man, like Esau, who sells his birthright for a mess of pottage. And yet, as you look at the power that Samson wielded in the destroying of that lion, was there some indication of his faith? Was there some indication that he recognized that God was with him, and that God, there had to be some concept that God was working in his life in some way? He knew who he was. He knew he had been called in this manner, and he knew he was a Nazirite. And when he destroyed that lion, he had to have had some concept that God was with him and working with him and empowering him to do that. And yet he turns around and does this unclean thing and deceives his parents as well. And then, in pride and in greed, he makes up a riddle when he goes down to the feast, and he uses this sin that he's committed of this lion and the carcass and the honey, and he makes a riddle out of it. And he does that in order to obtain 30 changes of clothes from the 30 companions or from 30 Philistines that he has been given. He's greedy. He's covetous. He wants. And it's like a challenge to him. It's like, I can win this. Without any thought at all for what he's done against God or against his parents, he just takes this opportunity now to make up a riddle about it, entertain and enrich himself. You know how that turned out if you read down through Judges 14. The woman that he was to marry kept nagging him, crying, weeping, "You don't love me. You don't love me. You won't tell me the answer." When in fact, she had been set up and put up to do that, to find out the answer so that the Philistines wouldn't have to give Samson 30 changes of clothing. So when Samson finds out about this, when he realizes that the woman has deceived him, when he gives in and tells her and realizes it was her that told the Philistines, what does he do? He becomes so angry that he leaves the feast and he goes down to a city, Ashkelon, and he kills 30 Philistines and takes their change of clothing and comes back and pays his debt with his 30 murders. Now you might say, well, wait a minute now. Samson was supposed to deliver Israel from the Philistines. But it's hard to look at this as anything but an act of total vengeance, total carnality, total anger. It's hard to see any kind of spiritual activity whatsoever in Samson's mind as he goes down to kill these 30 Philistines. It's hard for me to see him saying to himself, you know what, I'm supposed to serve God by delivering Israel from the Philistines, and so I'm going to go down. And that's not his motive at all. And yet God is going to work through him. Samson's carnal desires have gotten him nothing. He has no wife. He's broken his Nazarite vow. He's killed 30 men. And in the end, he's just angry. Sin is winning the battle with Samson. Hard to understand how he's listed in the Hall of Faith when you look at this man's nature. And yet, God has a plan. God is going to continue to work through Samson to accomplish his purposes. We do see that throughout the Bible, don't we? We see God working through wicked men. Is that Samson? Is there nothing but wickedness here in this man? Is there any faith at all in this man? It's hard to see as we go through these stories about him. We come to chapter 15 and we see God working mightily in Samson on two occasions. In chapter 15 and verses 1 through 20, after a while in the time of wheat harvest, Samson visited his wife with a young goat. He still considered her his wife. She had been given to his best man, and he didn't know that. He says, I'll go into my wife in her room, but her father did not let him enter. Her father said, I really thought that you hated her intensely, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please let her be yours instead. And Samson then said to them, this time I shall be blameless in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm. It's hard not to see in that statement Samson's just a little twinge of understanding that what he had done previously was not blameless. Was his own. Just kill those 30 men and take their clothing and pay my debt with it. But this time, I shall be blameless because now they've done me wrong, serious wrong. And they've given my wife to another man. So what does he do? Great story. He goes out and caught 300 foxes. I don't know how he did that, but he's a strong man. And, you know, it doesn't say he did it in one day. You know, so there's some evidence that these are actually jackals, which ran in packs of as many as 200. So there's no indication how he did it, but he did it. And then he tied two of them together, 150 pairs of foxes, tied their tails together. How did he do that without getting eaten alive by the teeth of these? I don't know. But anyway, he did it. And he took torches and he turned the foxes tail to tail, put one torch in the middle between two tails. And when he'd set fire to the torches, he released the foxes into the standing grain of the Philistines, thus burning up both the shocks and the standing grain along with the vineyards and the groves. He did a lot of destruction, a lot of damage to the economy of the Philistines. It's not indicated to what extent this happened, but it had to have been a large destruction. For the Philistines then said, who did this? And they said, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he took his wife and gave her to his companion. So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Who caused that? Who caused that? Samson did. This woman was burned with her father with fire. And Samson said to them, verse 7, since you act like this, I will surely take revenge on you, but after that I will quit. And that's not really a good translation. In other words, he's saying, I ain't going to quit until I get my vengeance. That's what he's really saying. I'm not going to quit until I get my vengeance. And so then in verse 8 it says, he struck them ruthlessly with a great slaughter. Literally, hip by... What does it say in your translations? Hip by thigh. Hip by thigh. The indication there, from everything I can gather on that, is that it was just pure hand-to-hand combat. There wasn't a weapon involved in any way. He just killed a massive slaughter of Philistines with his bare hands. And then he went away. Verse 9, Philistines went up, camped in Judah, spread out in Lehi. The men of Judah said, why have you come up against us? And they said, we've come up to bind Samson in order to do him as he did to us. And then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock of Elim and said to Samson, and these are Jews, these are Hebrews, these are Israelites, right? They're going to deliver Samson up to the Philistines. Again, some have made a connection there with Samson as a type of Christ, having been delivered up by his own people to the foreigners, just as Jesus was delivered up by his own people to the Romans. I don't know whether that's valid or not, but it is interesting to think about. So they said to him, he just says, don't kill me. Just don't kill me and I'll let you bind me. And he knows exactly what he's going to do, it appears, because when they bind him and he goes up with them and he just breaks the cords as if they were nothing. And he picks up the jawbone of a donkey, which again is something unclean that he's not allowed to touch, part of the carcass of an animal. And he takes that jawbone of the donkey and he kills 1,000 Philistines with it. And they all run. And he's done another massive act of vengeance upon the Philistines. Again, you might say, well, God is wanting him to do this. He's wanting him to be the deliverer, and so he's serving God. You don't see any indication at all in Samson that he's serving God in his mind and in his heart here. But could there have been some small amount of faith there? How else is he doing what he's doing? How else is he aware that he can do what he's doing? Perhaps some awareness on his part that it is God who is doing this for him. Now, at the end of chapter 15, God shows him how totally dependent he is. He has no water. And so he cries out to God in chapter 15 and verse 18. But notice the quality of his prayer. He became very thirsty and he called to the Lord and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. So he acknowledges God. You have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? You can see quite a lot of selfishness in there. Shall I die of thirst? But maybe there's some faith in that statement. Because to fall into the hands of the uncircumcised, to be one of God's weapons, clearly God is working through him to deliver Israel from the Philistines, and so for him to fall into the hands of the Philistines could be said to deny or to defame God's name. And so it could have been a prayer with some degree of consciousness of God and faith. But at the very least, he called out to God. So he had some awareness, some concept of God in his life. Now, finally, you see in chapter 16, Samson now goes deep into enemy territory, all the way to Gaza, all the way to the sea. He's way down in Philistine territory. And what's his purpose? There's a harlot that he's going to see. This is a lustful man. This is a carnal man. And then what happens is they find out that he's there and they come up against him. And in the middle of the night, about midnight, another amazing act of strength. He takes the gates of the city, puts them on his shoulders and walks them all the way from Gaza to Hebron. No small distance. Miles. It's incredible. Did he do that by faith? Was he aware of God's working in his life? It would seem that he was. Because at the very end of his life, he's going to do something similar. He's going to call upon God to help him to destroy the Philistines. Now, the rest of the story is about Delilah. He goes down to a different city. He finds Delilah there. He falls in love with her. He lusts after her. He falls in lust with her, you might say. And so she keeps begging him because the Philistines have come to her and said, look, we think you can get to him. Find out the secret of his great strength. And so she begins to plead with him. And he tells her something. And he makes it up. He says, it's because of this that I have great strength. He's playing with her. He's toying with her. And so she does that to him. And then she cries out, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. You know, as if she's warning him. You know, and they come in, but he immediately destroys the Philistines that come up against him. And then she does it again. You mocked me. You toyed with me. You mocked me. You didn't tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. And so he tells her another made-up story. Three times he does this. Three times he gives her a made-up story. Three times she does it and calls upon the Philistines. They come up against him and he defeats them. Three times he escapes them. And then she begs him and tells him, you don't really love me. You don't really love me. And he finally tells her all that is in his heart. I don't know that I'll ever get my head around that. You know, it's just ridiculous. this woman has shown him repeatedly that she's out to get him, to kill him. The Philistines three times have tried and failed. He knows what's going on here. But there's something about Delilah, I guess. Something about her begging him and her loving him and whatever it is. He weakens and he tells her the truth. He tells her all that's in his heart. But what's interesting about that is that this is something in which he declares to her and acknowledges to her that my strength is in my vow. My strength is in my Nazarite vow. And part of that vow is that no razor come upon my head. So now he's acknowledging the truth of the matter in a way that he understands that this strength that he has is from God because of a vow that he's taken. So again, do you see some semblance of faith in Samson, in this carnal, ungodly, lustful man? Little glimmers, you see. But what happens this time is that when Delilah calls in the Philistines after she's cut his hair off, Samson arises and he said, it's going to be just like the other three times. I'm going to destroy these Philistines coming after me. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. He didn't know. So he gets up. He's going to win. He gets taken captive. He's blinded. They put his two eyes out. They put him into prison. They mock him. He's gone from this strong, handsome man to a vile, mocked, ugly example of a man. The last part of the story shows the tragic but victorious end of a weak believer who continued to call on God. And that's the way I prefer to see Samson in my studies. That's the only basis upon which I can understand him being included in the hall of faith. At the very end of his life, when he's brought out to be mocked and jeered at a feast, there's 3,000 people on the roof of the pavilion of this great arena, and all the lords of the Philistines are there, and they bring him out to mock him and for him to put on a performance. And he asks that he can be put in between the two pillars, and the guard guarding him lets him do that, not knowing what he's going to do, doesn't really consider him to be a danger. And Samson calls upon the Lord one last time. But even in that cry to the Lord, he says, for my vengeance, that I may avenge my two eyes. He's still not where he needs to be, even at the end. But there is faith in God. There's faith that God is going to empower him, that God is working in his life. And so God gives him the strength and he destroys more Philistines in that last act, along with his own body, his own death. And that's the end of the story. So, in conclusion, what do you see here? What do you learn from this? What do you take away from Samson being listed? I don't think we would consider Samson a man of faith had he not been listed in Hebrews 11 as a man of faith. So it caused me to think a little bit about this. What do you really see here? God is taking an imperfect man, dramatically imperfect, maybe to make a point. Maybe to emphasize it, he's taking you. He's taking me. He's taking us. And he is using us for his glory. And he is empowering us and strengthening us along the way, even though at times we are weak and carnal and ungodly. Samson is the extreme. There's no justification or good example in him whatsoever, but it makes the point that God can take a man like that, who is willing to continue to put what little faith he may have had, to continue to acknowledge God, to continue to acknowledge that God was in his life, that God was working with him, that God was his help, that God was his strength. And he would call upon God at the end of his life, and he would say, Lord, I trust in you. Deliver me. That's the way I think I'm going to be at the end of my life. I think I'm going to be that way. I think I'm going to be like Samson. I think I'm going to look back my life and I'm going to say, Lord, you put up with me. You tolerated me. You used me for your glory. You strengthened me. You empowered me. You helped me to do good things in your service. You did all that. I didn't do it. I'm weak. I'm carnal. I'm lustful. I'm vengeful. That's my instinct. And you overcame that. You took that and you used that and you turned it for your glory. And now you're going to save me at the end of my life because I continue to trust in you and to trust in your grace and in your mercy. That's the only way I can see Samson at the end of his life being called a man of faith. Even Samson was saved, I believe. So to me, that's the story. That is the end result. So my final question to all of us is, like Samson, we can be blessed by God with strength to conquer the externals of life, to get through life, conquer the externals, but will we allow God to conquer in us the internals of the heart? That's what God's wanting to do, is conquer in us the internals of the heart so that our heart will never move away from Him, that our heart will be faithful to Him all the days of our life till the day we die, until the day we can be saved like Samson. I appreciate your good attention this morning. There may be someone here this morning who wants to obey Jesus Christ in baptism for the remission of sins. We want to make that opportunity available to you if you know what you're doing, if you know the commitment that you're making, and you know what God would require of you, then we want to make it available for you to be baptized this morning amidst all of these friends. If you're subject to the invitation of Christ, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.